reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hola, and happy Cinco de Mayo. Welcome to episode 15 of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Millott. Before I do my little introduction for my guest today, Ed Skoo, let me please do the little business thing again. If you're listening to the podcast on iTunes or on Stitcher, if you would, please go to those websites and give us a little rating. Maybe say a few kind words about us, write a review. I would greatly appreciate it. Help us get a little bit more recognition and expand that audience. That is all. Thank you. Of course, my guest today is Ed Skoog, Kansas native and brilliant poet. Old acquaintance of mine from my K-State days. We both got our BAs in English from K-State. Ed went on to get his MFA from the University of Montana, and he's taught creative writing all over the place, including New Orleans and Southern California and, well, everywhere, almost. He's had poems appear in the Paris Review, the American Poetry Review, the New Republic Poetry, Tin House. And he's got two full-length collections out there from Copper Canyon Press. The first one was Mr. Skylight, and the new one is Rough Day. And he also does a podcast called Lunchbox with Ed and John. And the John, of course, is the novelist J. Robert Lennon. He has lots and lots of books out there, so you can track him down, too, if you want. But today I'm talking to Ed Skoog, and I could tell you more about him, but I think we get it all covered pretty much in the podcast. A little bit of a warning. There's a little hitch about midway through the podcast. We were recording at his office on the Wichita State campus while he was there in April as the visiting creative writing professor. I smuggled in some beer to him, but shh, no one knows. Well, you do. Oh, great. Anyway. There's a little hitch. We got interrupted about halfway through. A student knocked on the door, and Ed stepped out for a moment. So there's a little gap there where you'll hear some people talking in the hallway, and then I turned off the recording and turned it back on and kind of missed the first part of a question that I asked when he sat back down. But it's not a big problem, and you shouldn't have any problems with it. So let's get right to my conversation with the wonderful Ed Skoog. Go ahead and give it a shot.
How's the sound? Does sound right? Level's good? Bright and airy? Aspirating?
Yes, we're doing well.
Sibilant?
It'll sound a little odd on my end, but everything should be
okay.
Set up. And I'm going to take these off here in a moment. Yep, we're good to go. All right, Ed Skoog.
Jason.
How you doing?
Doing great.
I know you haven't had a chance to listen to these yet, but I don't do a whole lot of research. mostly what I do is I talk to writers whose books I've read, stuff like that, people I know. And if I know them and haven't read a book yet, I like to get some of it read before I talk to them, even though it's really not a major topic. It's just kind of conversational.
Sure.
People that I want to talk more to. And let's get it right out in the open. We were both at K-State at the same time.
That's right. Kansas State University. Yeah. About 90.
What year did you graduate high school?
89.
So yeah.
I think you were maybe a year.
I was a year behind you.
You're behind me.
Yeah, because I graduated in 90, so I got there a little later. By that time, apparently, you'd already established yourself as quite the man about campus.
Had I?
That was what I always heard. you had the column in the paper in the Collegian, right?
For a little while. I wrote a column, yeah.
And what else?
It was fun. typed them in on these giant video display terminals in the journalism building that were about the size of a hog, each one of them, and slow. That was the first time I ever used computers, I think. But it was great. I liked writing a column. They were mostly nonsense. I can't look at them now. They're pretty badly. They don't really meet my standards. And I had a lot of unformed opinions that I that I argued strongly.
Yeah. Someone said you were in a band for a while. Was that right?
In college?
Yeah.
There was a band called Creep. Sort of a super group, more than an individual band with you know, musicians from other Manhattan bands.
Right.
Just throwing it together as a lark for a few special events. But we played a few things in Manhattan and in Lawrence. And I got to fulfill a dream of playing at the Outhouse, the punk rock venue in Lawrence. So that was great. That was much more of a music career than I had any right to hope for. It was 30 minutes on stage at the Outhouse in the 90s.
Who was in the group?
Well, you probably know some of them. Eric Moline, who was the drummer for In Order, Moving Van Gogh's, and then Truck Stop Love.
Yeah.
And then two Lawrence bands since then that have been pretty good. Old Brian Brooks played bass. I don't know if you knew Brian, who's a real metalhead. Eric Kahn, who's the drummer from Roach Factory.
Okay.
Who's still a drummer down in Austin. He played, I think, a hockey stick. I think he just hopped around on stage with a hockey stick. I played accordion and sang. We had a horn section with Ken DeLauder, played something. Christy Schar, the architect in Seattle now, she played the baritone saxophone. We had a trumpet player. We had the Creep family dancers. Tina Bell, Stacy Wright, and someone else, who were, ladies that we met our first day in college. Sort of my friends from the fifth floor of Marlatt Hall,
right?
Who I met by lunch on my first day in college, and then we met this group of girls from the girls' dorm at dinner,
right?
And that was pretty much who I hung out with for the next 4 years.
Wow,
that was it. People may have fallen away from that, but we didn't add a lot in, formed a protective shell.
So you played the accordion. You said.
I did.
Did you? Now, of course, you grew up in Topeka, right?
Yeah.
You had a big family, right?
I am the youngest. I'm the baby. I have four older brothers.
Wow.
And across the alley live five cousins, mm-hmm. Who are girls, who are all sort of one about the same age. So it was sort of like there were 10 of us, 5 and 5.
Was it an artistic, musical family?
No.
No? Were you the outlier in that regard?
Yeah, I'm the weirdo. I'm the weirdo of the family, without question. Loved, but probably disgust.
Really?
Yeah, probably disgust frequently in ways that I hope never to hear. There was people had some hobbies. There was some music in the house. Mm-hmm. We all had some piano training. Everybody played a band instrument briefly. But there were on my mother's side back on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. There was a little more of that. A couple of people who were writers and actors and singers.
Huh.
And I paid close attention to that. When we'd go back to D.C. where my grandparents lived in the summer for a week or two.
Oh wow!
My grandmother, who was just aghast that her grandchildren were growing up in Kansas, which she still imagined was populated by Indians from movies.
Right.
When my mother moved out to Kansas in the 50s, after she married my dad, my mother had her made sure that she had some riding lessons,
mm-hmm.
so that she would be able to ride a horse. And
because you never know when you need
and
that.
And had her take a lunch with an acquaintance who worked at the Bureau for Indian Affairs, mm-hmm. so that she would know what to anticipate in perhaps having to trade,
Right.
And she moves to, Topeka, Kansas in 1952, and completely urban life.
Completely,
But so when we would go back, my grandmother would spend as much time as she could hustling us into town for museums and plays and mm-hmm. And all that. And it really took, she got me a subscription to The New Yorker when I was 13 or something, And I had a cousin who wrote wrote these very popular books in the 70s when I was a kid about walking, like A Walk Across America, mm-hmm. The Walk West, just long walks that he took and then wrote about. And they're kind of corny in the 70s sort of way. It's a degree of you know, the seeker's journey to it.
Right.
But he was a big figure in my, not in my actual life, I only met him a few times, but in my imagination of you could grow up and be a writer.
Wow. Like yeah. That. I grew up out in western Kansas. I think the first time I, you know, really got introduced to a living and breathing in-person writer was when I took Intro to Creative Writing with Gary Clift.
Oh, yeah. Gary's a great guy.
Yeah. Helped me get into graduate school, so.
Yeah. I forgot what town you're from.
Well, I grew up out in Dodge City.
Yeah, that's right.
And went to high school down in Hayesville, which...
Hayesville is just outside of here, right?
Just outside of Wichita, and yeah. is really struggling, you know, psychologically with their past and what they're trying to become now. When I was in high school and shortly after, they tried at one point to have Shakespeare banned from the English classrooms because it was too offensive to some people, right? Mm-hmm. And since then, they've gone and really pumped up their high school and now are one of the only two baccalaureate programs in the state. Or at least in the Wichita area. Mm-hmm. East High has the other IB program that's mm-hmm. been around for years, and then mm-hmm. campus just started theirs last year.
So Shakespeare's...
Shakespeare
been
survived.
Restored to the curriculum?
Yeah, barely.
Mostly been stripped from university programs, or at least as a requirement.
Yeah, that's not right.
Well, it's interesting.
It is interesting, but it's not right, I don't think.
Yeah.
I still try to go back and read a play every year. Yeah. I am not very successful at getting back to it every year and doing it, so it's more like every other year.
What's your favorite Shakespeare play?
Measure for Measure.
Don't know that one that well.
And it's been a long time since I've read it, so I need to go back and reread it, make sure that is my favorite one. See, that's just kind of been my...
Memory serves me. It's about a couple of tailors, and they're trying to establish stores on rival street corners, and they join gangs. And
sounds like that's a cross between The Merchant of Venice and Romeo and Juliet.
And one of them is a small boy who discovers an alien and tries to hide it in his closet. And wants to use a phone.
Yes.
It's Measure for Measure, right?
Right.
Rides a bike across the moon.
Yeah, there's cross-dressing involved, I think, and a mysterious lover in the bed that's not supposed to be there.
Invisible man,
right?
Sleeping in your bed.
Exactly.
All Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like Twelfth Night a lot, and As You Like It.
Yeah.
But I do go back and read Lear a lot. Lear and The Tempest and mm-hmm. Winter's Tale. Kind of the last ones that will be kind of stranger and stranger ones.
Right. Did you see the movie they made with Helen Mirren as Prospero?
No.
That was amazing. You should check that out sometime. Anyway, did you start off as an English major?
No, I didn't. That's a good question. I went to Kansas State because I wanted to be a zookeeper.
And no shit.
I had worked at the Topeka Zoo, world-famous Topeka Zoo. All through high school, through an Explorer Scouts program.
Uh-huh.
So we were like junior keepers, and we got to do a lot of the work, you know, almost all the work that a keeper does.
Right.
I eventually got to do some of, you know, a lot of...
Wow.
Got to know the elephants very well, and the orangutans, and the gorillas, you know, meaningfully, you know, for me. And I wanted to be a zookeeper, and a lot of the zookeepers had gone to Kansas State.
Mm-hmm.
Wildlife biology degree. You have to have a biology degree to be a zookeeper. And so that was my plan. And then I heard about organic chemistry, and I looked at the book. You know, I guess I would have taken it my sophomore year. I hadn't enrolled in it yet.
Right.
But I saw it looming up ahead and realized that there's no way I would ever be able to pass organic chemistry. And so I switched to history for a hot minute at the encouragement of John Wiefald, the university president.
Right.
I think I asked him in some version of the question of what should I major in. And he said, "Well, I majored in history." I said, "Well, I'll try that." And there was a class at 8 a.m. that I signed up for. It was like one of the first history classes you take, and it was taught by a friend's father, Andrew McCullough's dad, John McCullough, who's a great teacher, and he had known me since high school from the debate circuit,
right?
And he had he had to fail me because I only went half the time,
right? Because
it was 8 a.m. I had other things. I had been doing other things, you know. So, but I think by the end of my freshman year, I was an English major.
Right.
I think I probably could have gotten through organic chemistry on the second try. I would have liked to have been a zookeeper. I still would like that.
But now you have a son, so that's like being a zookeeper, isn't it?
You have to deal with a lot of poop. Yeah, it's a lot of the same things. And you surround yourself. I mean, one of the ways that we teach kids things is through animals, right?
Right.
You know, anthropomorphic rhinoceroses. We go to the zoo a lot. So I feel like that was time well spent. I still have friends who are zookeepers.
Right.
And I think they're pretty happy. It beats you up. It's hard physical work.
Sure.
Doesn't pay very well.
How did you stumble in then? How did you stumble into English after zookeeping?
Well, I've been
history?
Writing poetry since I was 9.
Okay.
And I've been a big reader,
right,
from the age of 2 on. My house, I might have misrepresented my house growing up. Everyone was a reader.
Mm-hmm.
My folks were always reading. My brothers. Two of them were always reading. They were big sci-fi and fantasy nerds.
Right.
And so the house was filled with those paperbacks with great covers from, sci-fi books from the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And comic books. And so I read a lot of that growing up. And whatever my folks were reading, Stephen King.
Yeah.
Michael Crichton. Well, they weren't reading Proust, They were reading pop fiction, but that's pretty great.
Was that what started you writing on your own, just because you thought you could do that, or was there something in the environment?
I wrote my first poem at 9 when my grandmother died.
Oh.
Anna Haley, born 1904, died in 1980, and I didn't know her very well.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't real friendly. Didn't seem. I don't have any reason to doubt her love for her grandkids, but there were so many of them that,
right,
I was just another one. I was the last one of, 25 or 30 grandkids. So it was a different, aunts and uncles. In some ways that might've singled me out for her affection, but I was,
right,
I'm not sure she knew my name, but she died and I didn't understand really. It was the first death in the family. I didn't understand what was going on. Why my parents were upset, why my brothers were upset, my aunts and uncles. My Aunt Betty tried to explain death to me a little bit, and that was sweet of her. I didn't really, understand. And I couldn't really ask. I was 9. There wasn't really room at the table for my questions.
Right.
Because everybody else was dealing with things. And so I went upstairs and wrote a poem that kind of asked and answered questions and rhyme about what had happened to my grandmother, I found that two important lessons from that were enough to keep me writing. One is that in poetry I had access to a vocabulary and a way of writing, a way of speaking that it was not my natural voice.
Right.
Right. It's like, okay, in this mode I can say things I can't say in other ways. I have like superpowers.
Exactly.
Or anybody writing. In poetry, one has superpowers of language.
True.
Anybody writing it, as opposed to normal language. To the point that I believe very firmly that the whole point of us having language is to speak in poetry. I think poetry is the point of language, not some weird little byproduct or specialization. It's the whole point of it. And then... you know, at the funeral a few days later, I showed the poem to somebody. My dad or somebody read the poem at the funeral, and
oh, cool.
And I realized that not only could I speak in a new way in poetry, but that people would occasionally, under certain circumstances, listen.
Right.
And other than that, I mean, this is the 9-year-old weird kid in a big family, and my voice was not dominant.
Right.
You know. But here, I could speak,
mm-hmm.
or be spoken for, and so I kept with it. You know.
Right.
And that's what I've been writing seriously since I was 9. I say that, and it's true. I'm not necessarily writing well at any point along that spectrum, but very dedicated to reading and writing it,
yeah.
So that I could, you know, just keep doing it. Keep doing it.
I always forget who said it, but I think it was on an episode of Fresh Air. Terry Gross was talking to a poet or an English professor who had put together some collection or analysis of poetry. And I think to him, maybe it was just kind of some flippant comment or something that he just tossed off as a joke, but it stuck with me and I use it a lot. And he said, those who don't read poetry aren't fit to be let loose in the world.
I like that.
And I love that because I do think it's true. It's a bold statement, but that heightened focus on language of perception of the communication of that of how we perceive the world, how it filters through to us. It's a superpower, but it's also intensely human. And if we're not connecting with that, if we're not finding a way to connect to that and share that with something, I think there's definitely some good reason to lock us away from each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Because we can do a lot of damage. But I have to say that we can do a lot of damage with poetry.
True.
I mean, Slobodan Milosevic was a poet.
Yes, he was. So was Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb president, I think.
Yeah. So was Jor-El. Is that his name? Superman's father? Jor-El.
Jor-El, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of been, well, that's goes into one of the things that I've always kind of kept on the forefront, particularly after I got out of college, because I graduated. It took me 5 years because I was busy drinking.
It takes a lot of time. Especially if you're going to do it right.
If you're going to do it right. And that was right when the Bosnian War was wrapping up.
Yeah, yeah.
And all I remember from that was all the news coverage saying, well, there's this confusing civil war with this stuff and we don't understand it.
Turns out it wasn't confusing at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, that's bullshit.
It was to our advantage. It was to power's advantage for Americans to feel like it was inscrutable.
Confusing or whatever. And it was, I think it came out of the fact that we just didn't know how to deal with European Muslims.
That could be.
And confusing to us. So I started reading about the war because I didn't believe that it was confusing or beyond our comprehension. And one of the early books I read was Zavod Karazan's Sarajevo, Exodus of a City, which is his memoir about being in the city while it was under siege. And he has this great section called Literature and War, where he talks about the culpability and the responsibility that Yugoslav writers had for leading the country to that situation. There are the various nationalist poets that, you know, would write lines like, you know, die my brothers, wade in blood, to incite this.
That's my next book, by the way. Die my brothers,
wade in blood. And it's something that I always kind of get out there and almost argue with people about who just want to think that, you don't have to have any connection to the real world with your work.
Poetry is not pure. Literature is not pure. It's as responsible for as much misery as religion.
That's scary.
Well, they're all of a piece, right?
Yeah.
Religion, philosophy, poetry are all, I think, adjacent properties in that cul-de-sac of human futility.
Yeah, the futility of
a tall grass corporation.
Right, yeah. trying to figure out where we exist in the world, and of course you're going to get it wrong from time to time. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get horribly wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is depressing, but also, in a way, kind of uplifting because we can correct it, I think.
Well, you can try not to be ignorant, and you can try not to be pulling any funny stuff.
Right.
You know, you can have some ethics.
True.
But even then, you could be fooling yourself. But, you know, at least you're trying. You know, if you're writing, you're trying.
Make an effort, at least.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you finished at K-State, what year, did you do it in 4? Did you leave in 94? Or did...
You know, I ended up being 5 through a mixture of drinking and taking an extra year to serve as student body president.
That's right.
I could have graduated.
Wild turkey party,
so I actually
wasn't
graduated
it?
in the winter quarter, winter term, and the spring of the 5th year, I was a special student in architecture.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What is a special student in
architecture? Well, there's a category that was, you know, by permission of the dean, you could mm-hmm. be a special student, which I don't know what that category is for. But so it's non-degree, but it's a version of non-degree student, but not just auditing. I mean, it's things for credit. It had to be a certain kind of student in order to be student body president, but I already graduated, and I wasn't going to start a graduate program, so I'd already been accepted to a graduate program and deferred it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And Lane, I can't remember his last name, who was the dean of architecture, was a friend, and he said, "Oh, we'll do this." It wasn't phony. I had to take 2 classes in architecture,
right.
Graduate architecture classes, but they were theoretical, you know, classes. Or one was historical, one was theoretical, and it was interesting to me. I had a lot of architecture friends.
Right. Did they read the Poetics of Space in that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And learning from Las Vegas. And a book about the Italian writer Curzio Malaparte's house that he built. It was in the Godard film. Contempt.
Oh, wow.
A lot of it actually I thought was very applicable to poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a nice little mini education in modernism or
right.
in postmodernism.
So who are
in the way that I could understand a lot more clearly than that conversation in literary studies.
Right.
which kind of lost me. I'm sort of now up to speed with what has been discredited since.
Right.
Yeah.
I am horribly, horribly not up to speed. I mean, like I said, I grew up out in Western Kansas. There wasn't much literary thinking, books, museums, or anything out there. I mean, there was the
Boot Hill Museum.
And, you know.
Sod House.
Yeah, that was about
Kinsley.
It. You know, and... Yeah. I had a, went to a horrible, at the time, high school.
I'd trade a lot of museums for the sod house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think having grown up there, I would go with the museums.
You know Sean Bruce?
No, but somehow that name sounds familiar.
He's from Kinsley.
Okay.
And he has a great song about the sod house.
Oh, yeah?
Which is just, this sod house is made of dirt. It goes on. roof is grass and the... leave your initials. We don't care. We have plenty of sod to spare.
Right.
I got a cousin out in Spearville.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Going to go out and visit while I'm here.
That's the great emptiness out there.
Yeah. Just outside of Dodge, though. I think it's Edwards County.
Kind of northeast-ish, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So who are your guys? I would say that, you know, we as writers, to a certain extent, we get to choose our lineage. So who are the influences, the poets you go back to that you lean on that inspired you?
Yeah, I mean, Richard Hugo, certainly. The poet that I liked immediately when I read him when I was 17 mm-hmm. or so, and have continued to find valuable. I read his collected poems a lot, and I see them kind of more with a whole body of work, like a big collected, you know, book of poems from somebody who wrote a lot. If you get to know the work pretty well, you know the biography a little bit, it can be something like the pleasure of reading a novel.
Definitely.
In a way that supersedes the individual poems, the merits of the poems. So that's where I'm at with some of these poets. So I don't think about them, about their poetry so much as this sort of, lifelong performance art that... That's interesting to me. Michael Ndaji.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Important figure to me from the beginning. He's married to a Kansan.
Yes.
Deacon, Linda Spaulding, who's also a good novelist. And she, her father was a friend of my dad's. And so we went to Toronto for a conference about the time I was 9 mm-hmm. or 10. And we went out and spent the afternoon with them. And I was pretty impressed by him because particularly then he was a big, kind of hippie guy of what seemed of kind of indeterminate background, Sri Lankan. What is that? He had a British accent, big, burly, wild-eyed guy with a love of life, obviously, living this kind of bohemian life. And the kind of person that, frankly, in Topeka, my folks might cross the street to avoid. And yet they were showing him such deference and honor, both him and Linda. That I remember being on the subway back to our hotel afterwards and, trying to figure out why they gave him so much respect. Right. I certainly did right away. He was kind of a kid magnet, just a very charismatic person. And they said, "Oh well, he's a writer,
right?
All right, that's what I want to be. I want to be that. I want to be that. If you can live like that, and be a clearly a independent mind,
right?
Full of passion and curiosity for the world, a kid basically, and still get that kind of respect from authority from my parents." Thought that's not a bad path, and so I started reading him. And of course, mostly what he'd written by then was poetry, and then the collected works of Billy the Kid, kind of experimental novel.
He was my big discovery in graduate school, which entirely changed the way I approached writing on my own. I didn't really know anything about him, and turns out that he's good friends with Robert Creeley. And one of Bob Creeley's ex-wives, Bobby Louise Hawkins, was teaching out at Naropa. And she was my advisor. So, the way Naropa was set up, you had the summer writing program, and then you'd do two semesters, another summer writing program, and two semesters, and you're out. Quick, solid 2 years, just straight going on. In the summer writing programs, they bring in all these writers. And the first summer I was there, Ondaatje showed up to do a panel with Bob Creeley and Robin Blazer. And
Blazer's very interesting.
Very interesting. And I listened to him speak and read some of his work and fell in love with him. And by the end of the fall semester, I had read everything that I could get my hands on by him. Absolutely fell in love with him. Just marvelous, marvelous. That's, I was so happy that there's somebody else who loves him that I've come across. Everybody, they're like, "Oh, I know who he is. Yeah, that English patient, right?"
Well, I think his reputation suffers a little bit because of the great success of the English patient. And the movie is, although the movie was successful, it's a little corny. Well, the book is fantastic.
Oh, absolutely.
But his that and the novels since then, what Anil's Ghost and Divisadero, have been sort of increasingly conventional.
Yeah.
And so I think he doesn't seem as daring as his early and middle work are.
Have you read The Cat's Table yet?
No.
Oh, that one's good. That one it's a lot better than. Anil's Ghost and Divisadero, and it gets kind of back a little bit more to the poetics of it. And I think there's, because there's a certain amount of affection that he has for the topic, it's a little bit more, he argues against it sometimes, but it's as close to, it's a bit like Running in the Family in a way, mm-hmm. Although more fictionalized than Running in the Family was. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think that personal connection brings out some of that passion for what he was doing a little bit more than the other two.
Yeah. His poetry is very strange.
Yeah.
You know, it's a nice antidote to what I might have stumbled into, and did stumble into, sort of, you know, the polite regionalism.
Right.
That is comforting, but not very challenging. Weird poems that don't make any sense. Look strange on the page. I like that.
I think I was guilty of that in college.
Creeley, too. I mean, Creeley I like very much. I mean, I started reading William Carlos Williams a lot in high school and sort of followed that line, which diverges, right? Diverges towards, on one hand, towards language poets and, you know, Creeley in another direction and in some other ways.
Go ahead. Hold on.
We lived in a violent neighborhood and it had been particularly rough, and we'd gotten a little scared. I think it happened to us. It was the year before Katrina was not a good year for New Orleans. Things were getting a lot of things were getting bad and worse, and they're sort of getting back to that level now of non-storm related hopelessness and dysfunction. And you add to that the storm-related dysfunction, and it can be rough. It's still the best place in the world to be, and I miss it every day.
Yeah.
And continue to slowly plot my return.
How do you think it, one, New Orleans in general, and two, Katrina affected what you were writing about?
Everything. Katrina changed everything for me, in how I see. In my outlook in my politics, a lot of it, I saw that all authority lies all the time, even often for your own good, but it just becomes second nature. Authority is lying.
Right.
Authority and lies are inseparable. And that's a problem.
That's a huge problem.
That's a problem. And as a poet, writing poetry is a kind of authority, and it is a kind of lying. I mean, it's implicated in that. Mm-hmm. It's not the antidote. It's implicated in it, and all the more reason to be suspicious of it, and to be suspicious of what it is that you're saying or what role you're playing.
Right.
So my first book, Mr. Skylight, comprises poems from about a 10-year period, but is all, I mean, every line is rewritten and reconsidered in the light of the shock of what happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, because the hurricane, of course, was unavoidable, but the flooding of New Orleans was entirely a man-made catastrophe. Foreseeable, admitted as such by the Corps of Engineers that they were lax in the building of the levees. They didn't build them as deep as the plans said.
Right.
Federal malfeasance led to the flooding of New Orleans. 1,000 people dead.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands of people displaced. Significant cultural treasures lost. It's damage to the world to do that to New Orleans. It's criminal. And it was visited upon us from the outside.
Seems like there's some despair in that. on your part?
Sure. Well, Skylight is kind of about the texture of that experience, and mm-hmm. and I want to be clear that it's not my experience. I was 10 days out.
Right.
You know. Now we still owned a house there, and the house was destroyed, and we spent years, you know, going back and rebuilding it, and just, you know, trying to be a good company to friends. We took, you know, during the month or two, a lot of people came and stayed with us or our parents in various places, and ended up taking 14 or 15 students from the school that I taught at in New Orleans, mm-hmm. coming out to the school in California and getting a free $50,000 a year education.
Wow.
To finish up there, so their arts education would not be interrupted.
Right.
And those students are doing a lot better as adults than the kids who stayed.
Right.
Because it was tough to be a teenager
in a destroyed city.
War zone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the National Guard was, you know, patrolling for a couple of years with a 10 o'clock curfew. And I mean, you know, and all the things that are difficult about being a teenager, about being a teenager in New Orleans were just, you know, the roof was just taken off, and a lot of people kind of got lost. And so the second book is more about the rebuilding. Rough Day is, mm-hmm. so the first one's sort of about the shock and the texture of that experience. Rough Day is more about the rebuilding of New Orleans, and the rebuilding of anything after a rupture, sort of on the personal side, sort of
right.
how to rebuild the self after, you know, after I lost my mother, you know, what that does to you. And the sense that we're all in constant migration, mm-hmm. and restlessness, and how to sort of adapt to that, or how one might be able to get some perspective on how they might eventually adapt to that by acknowledging it, and you know, dealing in a world of in which all language is, most languages is against you,
mm-hmm.
is authority lying at, trying to control you, and how much nicer it is to try to shake free of that. Because otherwise, it'll kill you.
Right. Are you you're kind of in between, I guess you'd say, academic lives right now. You're the visiting writer here at Wichita State for this month, and it seems like you've been kind of piecing together these visiting writer assignments for a couple of years now, right?
Well, as I've taken them as they've been offered, I haven't really sought them.
Okay. Yeah. And there was one episode of Lunchbox with your friend J. Robert Lennon where you talked about you weren't really wanting to get back into the full-time teaching thing.
No, I might revisit that in 5 years or so, but
right.
I don't like the process of getting an academic job is very, very slow. I mean,
yeah.
it's a 6 to 8 month process between announcing a position and someone taking it. And there's so many very qualified people who are mm-hmm. fine writers, with the recognition to show that in addition to their own work showing it, and with teaching experience, and there's so many people for so few jobs.
Right, they keep turning out more of them every year.
Yeah, it's a con. It's criminal, and I just don't want. I've gone on interviews. I've come close to having jobs. And I have no doubt that eventually I would have one or will have one.
Right,
but I can't go through just being on the market again. It's just too long a process. And at the end of it, what do you get? You get a job. Well, you can just get a job.
Yeah.
Any kind of job. Be a zookeeper.
If you can stomach it.
Yeah, you can get a job. I mean, jobs are... It's sick, the alliance between being a writer and a lot, many other kind of imaginative workers
right.
in America right now and the universities. And it started out innocently enough, but it's become... paralyzing and just a sad
yeah.
and sick and so if anybody, but if anybody's hiring, I'll talk to you. We can have a conversation.
There's nothing like
a lot of this is insurance. A lot of this is sour grapes, and some of it is true. But the intensity to also that, you know, I've got a kid and I need to support him, and I can't wait around for these jobs. I'll go work at McDonald's. I don't give a fuck.
I understand. Now, just out of curiosity, when you went off to Montana, did they offer funding? I mean, was it teaching, fully funded type of thing?
It wasn't fully funded. I mean, I taught my second year. I had a little bit of a recognition for the first year, but mm-hmm. I think we might have paid $4,000 or something. Seemed manageable. That's where I wanted to go. It's the only place I applied for graduate school because I wanted to go and I wanted to study with these specific people and be in this town of writers. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to fish. I was very serious about fly fishing at the time, and that was the place to do it.
Yeah.
I'd spent some summers working in Yellowstone National Park,
right,
and gotten to know the area. And like it very much, and I still like it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I guess what I'm getting at is one of the kind of things that I always tend to ask. It's my one, I guess, aside from getting, you know, people's origin stories, is that we're in kind of a weird situation right now. We have the MFA machine, mm-hmm. and that academic program, and on the other end, you know, Chad Harbach came out with that book, The MFA versus NYC. Have you heard about this one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read some responses to it.
And I started reading it, and I'm kind of, it seems a little bit too, you know, black and white, cut down the middle. And I worked a number of years as a bookseller before I sold mine. And here in Wichita in particular, I've confronted a lot of self-published writers. Which there are some self-published writers that do it correctly. They really take on the role that I am a publisher in this case. And so they go out and they hire an editor and a designer and they actually make an effort to do it right.
Make a good book.
To make a decent product and make sure it's presentable. And then there are the ones that just put whatever Word document they want out there on Smashwords and then call themselves a writer, put on their little beret and smoke a cigarette and want to talk to me like, you know, we're equals.
But who's to gainsay such dreams? I mean, they might be really good.
They might be. You know? But
there's a lot of writing that goes through all of the official hoops and is trashed.
Horrible.
And,
exactly.
So I don't see it because there's so much official, you know, sanctified trash.
Right.
I don't feel any great the disdain gatekeep, for
yeah.
For
the gatekeepers like to elevate themselves as to somehow being more.
I prefer my trash copy edited.
Yes.
But that's declining.
Oh, it is.
That's declining.
True.
And you can, you know, a book from one of the major publishers and you'll find
it's horrid.
The standards for, you know, for what can pass it's gone because they aren't copy edited.
Yep.
By and large.
But we have this weird new playing ground because of self-publishing, because of the celebrity model that New York is under, where they're hiring, they're publishing books by famous people in order to do maybe one unknown writer on the back end that they may decide to abandon at the last minute.
Or Grey Wolf. The James Franco book.
Yeah.
Which might, I have nothing against James Franco, but you know, I'm sure the argument for themselves is. They probably believe in the book, but also if this does really well, think of how many non-James Francos we can publish.
Right,
and that's well. I mean, for a publisher, that makes sense. I'm not opposed to that thinking. If it works, it's just that it doesn't usually work. It's like universities and football teams.
Right.
I mean, the idea is that it's going to raise so much revenue, and you know, it'll help other things, and it kind of does. Mm-hmm. But it kind of takes over.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, it takes over, and it tends to enforce its own almost formula onto everything. funny story. Maybe not funny, but I actually stumbled across Lennon's book, his first book, The Light of Falling Stars, at a Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. It was under the year it came out, Discover Great New Writers thing.
It was the first year of the Discover New Writers program.
I picked it up because I was flipping through it first because I was working on a my own sort of theory about the universe of literature, and that there was a Iowa formula and a quote unquote Iowa conspiracy. And was pleased to see that he hadn't gone to Iowa, that he'd gone to Montana. And the only reason I bought the book was because I was reading through the acknowledgments page and your name was on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, Skoog. Yeah. All right, I'll read it. And I liked it. It was really good.
It
although,
good
unfortunately,
book.
I've lost track of his other stuff. And he's got a shelf
of things
now.
Oh, he's got 8 or 9 books.
Yeah. And I haven't kept up with him, but I liked it. So I'm going to go back.
Each one is better than the last.
Good.
Mailman is one that really has legs, I think. I really do believe that each book is better than the last, but Mailman is different. It's just a longer book. It's like his Stand. It has nothing to do with the Stand, but in the same way that this is one that
it's epic.
This took takes up a little more space in your mind, just because of its scale. And he's going to have a book of short stories finally. I mean, he's been publishing short stories in The New Yorker and Playboy and Esquire and Paris Review.
I've seen a few of his essays
for almost
around
20 years.
Yeah.
But he's never done a collection of stories. And he had lots to choose from, so he was able to winnow down. I think it's going to be, I know all the stories. I know it's a magnificent book. It comes out in November.
But the point where I was going with that is that we have this tendency, I think, because of the major publishing houses and the way that they're going, we're creating this formula. There's a way to have a book marketed. The publishing industry likes to put genres on everything, and it leads in fiction and in poetry to this kind of stuff that we've both said we dislike, that provincialism, that unchallenging.
I don't dislike it.
I
recognize it for what it is,
but it's
often still very.
It's not necessarily bad, but it's not challenging. It's not risky.
If it is actually of my region, I'm likely to be kind of interested in it, the way that I like a painting of a barn that I also that looks like it's where I'm from. I can look at it and feel kind of softly towards it. You had a point. But I wanted to talk about Tiny Wichita.
Tiny Wichita, right.
Or the tiny imaginary Kansas town in the exploration place, down on the river.
Yeah.
The Ark River, downtown in Wichita. I've got a kid, so I've gone there a number of times. It's fantastic. And it has a miniature Kansas town, unnamed.
Right.
Because it has little buildings from all over sort of central Kansas and some other places. Although a friend pointed out, no synagogue.
No synagogue. Okay.
No synagogue in the perfect Kansas town. No mosque. Plenty of several churches.
Several churches. Yeah.
When in fact, a lot of little Kansas towns, even little Kansas towns, have or had a synagogue. I felt probably more sentimental standing in there and watching sort of the day pass, because it has a 15-minute circuit of the day passing over this sort of giant model railroad town of Kansas than I have driving around Kansas.
Right.
And it's sort of like these poems. It's like I can get soft-hearted. It's like a deer has walked into the room,
Yeah.
I like seeing places that I know depicted fondly, but they don't make me angry, but they do have their limitations.
Right. Do you think though that those poems, yes, they make us feel warm and fuzzy for places, that bit of nostalgia that's going on, but do you think that there's a certain, because of their safety, because of their I don't want to say blandness, but their plainness. And because of the drive for formula, for easily classifiable fiction and whatever, that we that there is something in that that's causing the what the NEA finds in their annual surveys of the decline of literary reading of poems, of fiction and things like that. Is it because we have become too safe, too locked away in MFA programs, writing to other writers and just picking up a few peripheral readers as we go?
It's easy to imagine that it's true. I think one thing that has happened is probably some writers who might have written more interesting books, having found that they could write perfectly adequate books and have the same, you know, level of success, which is, you know, the comfort of a assured job, mm-hmm. in the university. It's probably caused some people to write. I would say it's probably caused some writers who might be tame to write more wildly because they have the safety, but also probably some wild writers to become, you know, be more tame and not to write with an audience in mind. And right. So there's no audience. Well, I think you can always assume an audience. Alice Notley says you can always assume an audience. The book implies an audience. But you know, it certainly had an effect, and because the state of things is not healthy, then it's easy to say. I mean, some basic laws of causality would suggest that it's partly responsible. But I don't know if it really is. And I have no problem with whatever people need to do to make a living. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I don't want to tear down the MFA programs.
Right.
You know.
No, I'm not really interested in tearing down MFA programs either.
It's like
to build
up a readership.
Because I think we don't have a good, because of the economy, because of the way our society is going, you know, monetarily, we don't really have the ability for a true apprenticeship type of program. You can't, and we're really, oftentimes the MFA is the only chance that a young writer, say from, you know, Western Kansas, where there are no writers to talk to, can actually go and spend time, you know, around that thing that they never would have gotten a chance to without it. I think if it wasn't for the MFA program, if it wasn't for majoring in creative writing at K-State, you know, I'd be working at Boeing or have joined the Army or something. I would not be a writer. I would, and I'm so far behind on reading and picking up stuff.
But when you say it out loud, it's, you know, as an actual grown up,
yeah,
the sort of two sides of that. You know, there's both like, thank you MFA programs,
right,
for keeping me from having a interesting and lucrative careers.
Right, you know? Right.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I've always been thinking about is that, you know, there is a lot of hand-wringing from certain people. You know, every year or so, there's that cycle of articles and essays that come out, people wringing their hands about the decline of readership.
Yeah,
and I'm like going, and maybe it's just because the lineage that I chose to latch on to is like, well, do something about it. You know, get out and engage the audience
write the thing that's undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think write the thing that people need, and they'll read it. You know, I think I don't know of, well, I know of a lot of books of poems that I think I wish everybody would read, but I can understand why they don't. But I can imagine the book. I mean, I sort of believe in the holy grail of the book that is both aesthetically uncompromising,
mm-hmm.
that suddenly everybody needs to have on their shelf.
Right.
You know. Well, there's some poets who can do that, who are capable of that. Matthew Zapruder, Matthew Dickman, you know, in particular. Ellen Bass,
mm-hmm.
Ben Lerner, any poet from Topeka. Catherine Barnett, you know, they're poets who are capable of it.
Is there anything else, though, you think that writers could be doing as you know, as far as outreach, public engagement, or thing like that, to get people's ears to prick up and get curious.
No, I don't think it's on the writer's part. I think, I mean, although you know, I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm a, you know, in the, I communicate in the contemporary forms with
right.
people. But as a writer, I wish that I didn't, and I admire people who don't. I think that the roles of publishers and booksellers, that's the challenge, is how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The thinking is that people want to hear from the writer and that the writer needs to be pushing it, but I don't see that working.
Right.
And it may make a margin between a book selling 5,000 and a book selling 6,000. I don't know if it makes a book a bestseller. In fact, I think, it can get in the way. I believe in publishers and I believe in booksellers and their ingenuity,
mm-hmm.
at being able to find ways of doing it. You know, I don't know. People just need to get off their ass and buy a book.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's anything that, I don't think writers do anything wrong or publishers or booksellers are doing anything wrong. It's all those non-reading motherfuckers who need to get in line. You know? Not that I've been reading much lately with a kid. I don't get to read anything. I'm just as bad as anybody about that. I'm making an effort. But I think it can be hard to find time to read. When you have the opportunity not to, and you know,
right.
you've got obligations, and what you know, what I do pick to read at this point is not necessarily what I was reading. You know, I'm not reaching for Heinrich von Kleist and Robert Walser as much as I am looking for what my parents read. You
right.
know, some light entertainment. You know? But that'll hopefully my brain will come back eventually. I'm looking forward to that. It'd be nice to be reunited
with it. Yeah.
Reunited with the brain.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, thank you.
I apologize for my swearing, by the
no,
way.
No, fuck it. That's I mean the thing goes out as explicit. I mean the episode I'm posting this Monday, an episode I recorded with Teresa Romaine, mm-hmm. who is a writer here in Wichita, does romance novels. Mm-hmm. And we go off for like half an hour on Yeti bondage porn.
Nice.
Right. So
I'll listen to that one. Yeah.
Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Jason. It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
After all these years.
All right. And there you have it. My conversation with Ed Skoog. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And in a couple of weeks, we'll have another podcast. I'm not sure who it's going to be. I'm working on getting those recordings set up right now. And until I get them actually in the can, I don't want to say who I'm going to talk to. So look out for May the 19th. We'll see. It should be good either way, no matter which one talks to me first. I'll see you then. Bye.